Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Bonjour, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, cravat collector Letty P, no relation to Master P. And joining me today is a man who's into stealing from paraplegics, FlixWise co-producer Mr. Martin Kessler.
I'm one bad mother.
Shut your mouth. It's easy. Yeah. Well, Martin, I think it's... Sorry I gave you that one, because you're... It's funny, because you're
no,
like
true.
A nice guy.
It's true.
Okay. Steal all the time. Just cannot stop stealing from paraplegics. And standing aloof, smoking a Gawa cigarette. And his FlixWise debut is Battleship Retention editor, Scott Nye. Welcome, Scott.
Thanks for having me. This is one of my favorite podcasts.
All right, well, thank you. And it's an honor to have you. And yeah, are you so excited to talk about...
So excited.
So excited.
I thought you were going to finish that sentence,
I know,
so I'm like sitting here like, so, talk
nope,
about what?
Nope, nope.
Okay.
Okay, well, I just have to quickly point out, we have two guys and a lady, which is maybe appropriate. We'll see what kind of trouble we can get into. And speaking of troublesome trios, today's Sight and Sound entry is Jean Eustache. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that right.
Sounds
close
good.
Enough. Jean Eustache's 1973 feature Les Mamans et la Putain, which translates to The Mother and the Whore, and that is what I will be calling it. Do not ask me to pronounce any more French today, please. Right off the bat, just want to offer a disclaimer. No one has seen this movie, like maybe five people. And we will keep that in mind when discussing the film. I don't think we have to worry too much about revealing anything or spoiling anything. This film is not spoilable. So I just want to say, have no fear. If you have not seen this film, you can listen, and if you should come upon it someday, it's still worth watching, even if we've told you about all the details. And I really don't think in the span of this podcast we will cover everything there is to know about the film. So if you have an opportunity, check out the film. Otherwise, you know, you can just listen to this. That works too.
We will be the definitive.
Yes. Yes.
No pressure. It's going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And since this is such a behemoth of a movie, we're going, and like I said, it's a runtime of about three and a half hours, a little over 3.5 hours. So we're just going to stick with the one topic today, with extra time allotted to really dig into this film and how it ended up so high on the list, despite no one having seen it. And then, as usual, we will still close things out with some final notes of positivity. All right, you guys ready?
Let's do it.
I guess so.
Do it. All right, which one of you two wants to be the whore?
I'm not feeling very motherly today, so I think by definition...
You get the whore. Our first and only topic for today is the number 59 film on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Jean Eustache's The Mother and the Whore. The film takes place in Paris a few years after the tumult of the May 1968 strikes and protests. The revolutionary spirit that once ignited the city has long since flickered out, giving way to a stubborn defeatism. This permeating sense of ennui sets the stage for the events of the film. The events, or non-events, involve a love triangle that forms between a feckless young philosopher named Alexander, who's played by Antoine Doinel himself, Jean-Pierre Léaud, and the two women that he somehow cons into falling in love with him in spite of his horrible taste in neckwear. One woman, the ostensible mother, is Marie, played by Bernadette Lafont, a clothing store owner who spends her hard-earned money babying Alexander, making sure he stays clothed, fed, and codependent. Marie and Alexander appear to have an open relationship, which doesn't preclude other romantic dalliances. However, when Alexander meets Veronica, the quote-unquote whore, who is not actually a prostitute, but rather a nurse, he brings Veronica to his and Marie's shared apartment, and, of course, jealousy starts brewing. Alexander does his best to placate Marie's concerns about his growing emotional attachment to Veronica, while also trying to satiate Veronica's big sexual appetite, or at least I think we're meant to believe it's big. The film plays differently through 21st century eyes. However, when the film was first released, its frank depiction of sexuality, particularly female sexuality, was considered groundbreaking. While there are a handful of physical love scenes, most of the sexuality involves characters talking about sex, what they like, what they don't like, the different ways that society regards male and female sexuality, and how larger societal influences tend to categorize women into reductive archetypes. I won't reveal what happens to this love triangle in the end, because I recognize that many of you have likely never seen this film. It's not available on DVD or VOD in the States, and unless you're lucky enough to have caught a rep screening, this movie is basically out of print. And yet, despite the unavailability, the film has maintained its stature as one of the greatest films ever made. We're going to talk about how its legacy has been upheld and whether the difficulty in seeing the film helps or hinders its reputation. But first, I want to hear what my esteemed panel thinks about this movie. Martin, should we start with you? I know.
Okay.
I know. Thoughts?
And it's tough because, like you said, that there's not a whole lot about the film. Like, if you go on the Sight and Sound list, there's usually a little written summary for each film. But there's no summary for La Mama et le Poutet, so I really didn't feel like I was going in blind to some degree. Like, most of the films on the list that we've talked about, I've either seen or at least was familiar with their reputation. But this I really wasn't, so it was completely kind of new to me. And you know, sometimes like you can form your opinion about a film by, you know, you go and see what other people think and you go, well, I disagree or I agree because of this, and kind of form an opinion that way. This I thought, like, for me it was a little bit trickier. I sort of had this big film to digest, and all along the way I sort of felt like, well, you know, do I like this? I don't like necessarily being with these people. You know, I guess I did like the film ultimately, or to a point anyway. You know, yeah. I think like they did feel very real, these characters, hipster type characters that you feel like people I've known, all their little ironies and insecurities mixed with the over earnestness and overreactions, the people who think they're above it all, that know all the cliches, but they are a cliche and they're just as self-destructive and destructive to anyone they come into contact with. I don't know, like, for me the like image of the film was the Jean-Pierre Léaud sitting at a table with sunglasses indoors pretending to read a book while he's just scowling at two guys chatting up the women he was just with. You know, like, it's I think showing characters who aren't necessarily, well, I think it's showing characters who I think are flawed and often unlikable, but it's a very unflinching I think authentic feeling look at those types of people. So I did like it, I guess.
Okay.
Sorry. That was too much.
No, I think that's fine. Yeah, I think it's helpful to know where we're coming at this film from. And so, Scott, when did you first see the film and did you like it? And do you still like it?
I do still like it. I first saw it, I guess at this point, 6 years ago when I first moved to Los Angeles. At the time, CineFamily was offering 1 month at a time memberships. So I just got a 1 month membership, and that theater lets you get in for free once you have that membership. And at the time, they were doing this whole series on French love films. And so I just went to see a ton, and this was one of them. And I like loosely knew it was kind of a big deal. I think I remember it from the They Shoot Pictures list. And maybe, like, loosely the Sight and Sound list. But then I got there, and the theater was, like, completely sold out. Like, everybody in town was coming to see this movie. And so I was like, well, this is a big deal. And it's an interesting film to watch with an audience because it is kind of an endurance test over 3.5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And that really drives home how exhausting and insufferable the characters can be. But at the same time, I think, like Martin said, that it's very truthful and honest about kind of destructive behavior and... you know, in some ways, it's refreshing to see kind of our worst impulses put up on the screen. I am somewhat ashamed to say I can relate in some instances to what the characters feel and express, although I would never go as far as they do. But at that same time, I feel like the ends that Eustache and his cast take their characters to are very true, and I could see myself ending up in their position if I made a lot of wrong decisions along the way.
That's very telling. Okay, so my relationship with this film began, I think, either in high school or first couple years of college. My friend, Caroline Gollum, shout out to Caroline. I remember she was heavily into rep cinema, and even when she was, 17 or whatever, and she was making a big deal about going and seeing this movie called The Mother and the Whore. And she was just describing it, and she's like, it's a 4-hour French film called The Mother and the Whore. And I just went, of course it is. Jesus Christ. it sounded so horrendously cliche, and it's about French people sitting around and talking. And so in my mind, its reputation has been cemented in my mind as being this ponderous, French, impossible to see, it was for a select group of people it's for the people that he's depicting in the movie, right? To me, it became a symbol of something that I couldn't quite put my finger on, but it's like
it's
a kind
French
of...
French cinema all went wrong.
Yeah. Possibly. It's more of an inside joke in my mind between me and myself at this point. I always wanted to keep it that way. It was always going to be this thing that existed that I was never going to see because it's funnier. It's better as a symbol than it is as a movie, I think. it functions so well as the ultimate self-indulgent French film. right? but now, having seen it, I don't know that I feel all that differently about it. I will say that the version that I saw... we need to talk about this. The subtitles were translated by a German person. So the English subtitles are translated by a German person. I'm not sure. So the pronouns were all over the place. So I don't know that I really got all of it. But I think I got the overall gist of it. So with all those prefaces and caveats in mind, I think I liked it more than I thought I would. And it does capture something about the sort of disheartened, just disappointment of that kind of feeling that you get in your late 20s where life kind of doesn't turn out the way you want it to. And you're sort of trying to figure out how the youthful exuberance is gone. And so you're trying to kind of reestablish your identity as an adult, and it's not going very well. And that position is always going to be fraught, but it's just going to be especially fraught if you are this Alexander guy. And I don't know, were you guys able to kind of go along on his journey? Are you able to indulge him? I don't know. Because I wasn't sure exactly how we're meant to feel about the characters. On the one hand, they're ridiculous because, again... people in their 20s are ridiculous. That's like common knowledge. But is the film making fun of them, or does it kind of genuinely feel for them? Does it vary from character to character? What do you guys think?
I think there's an element of kind of that satirical angle in there. But I think it's similar to Eric Romare or more recently the show Girls, which kind of takes its characters... earnestly in the long run, but jokingly in the short run. Mm-hmm. The things they say are often very silly, and the things that people get obsessed with in their 20s and really focus on for long periods of time seem very silly, but it's still sympathetic to the kind of emptiness that that focus and obsession leaves them with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're supposed to take the characters, I think, seriously on the overall arching, but each individual conversation probably isn't the most as thought-provoking as they think it is.
Right. Martin, how about you?
Yeah, I think so.
Roughly the same, yeah.
I mean, I was also reminded of the TV show Girls and Tiny Furniture while watching this. But Yeah, like I think there are moments where, you know, the act out in melodramatic ways, big ways, and it's not the film being melodramatic. I think it's the characters. You know, it's like, oh, the menage a trois is not going well. I'm going to go down these pills, or moments like that. Yeah. You know, they're sort of darkly funny. I mean, it's maybe like a little bit of that cringe humor that's kind of popular right now. I mean, it's maybe more on the cringe side than the humor side, but there are moments I thought was funny, like when she's speaking about her sexual history very frankly and asks, like, does it shock you? And he says, no, it excites me. And she goes, sugar in your tea? And he goes, yes, please. so like, I think there were obviously things that were meant to be funny.
Yeah.
You know, so like, it did have me kind of laughing at these characters on a moment-to-moment basis, but it also feels like it takes a serious look. Like, I think if it was maybe overly satirical or like a straight-up satire of young people and their goals and ambitions, like I don't think it would have this kind of a tone. Like, it does feel like it, you know, is ultimately pretty serious, and there are moments that do seem to break through that youthful philosophizing into something that feels maybe a little bit more, you know, there were moments that felt like they weren't just talk, like they were grounded in some kind of experience more towards the end of the film, mostly I think from the Veronica character, and mm-hmm. then the Leo character seems to be in sort of a downward spiral that right. he will drag everyone else down if he can, but mm-hmm. That was yeah. just sort of my...
Yeah, I liked it. I thought, you know, it balanced the humor and the pathos really well, and that it's like sort of by the end you're like the Alexander's kind of in a spiral, and it becomes almost screwballish, him trying to balance the needs of both of these women, and yet the speech that Veronica gives about how she's not a whore, that was affecting, you know. And it did, now that you mention it, it does kind of remind me of Girls, and I do feel like one, like I said, I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. On the other hand, I totally understand someone who sees this movie and goes, I cannot indulge these people, just as one might watch Girls and go, I can't, yeah. I cannot care, I cannot make myself care.
I mean, it does sort of, I think like Girls reach that point, and I think this film borders on reaching that point maybe, but it does kind of pick the right moment, I thought, to get out while it's ahead, you know. I mean, if this yeah. was a television series, at a certain point it would be unsustainable, right?
Right.
No, I'm glad you mentioned screwball comedy though, Pauline, because I do think it's a similar sort of arc where it's people kind of running around and going between different relationships and grasping at different straws and then kind of throwing their hands up in the air and landing at a solution that seems like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in a screwball comedy, the solution they end up would seem like a happier ending than it does here, where Jean-Pierre Léaud's like shaking on the floor yeah. after what should be like,
what just happened?
For many people's memories, the happiest moment of their lives.
Yeah.
But less so for him, I would say.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on whether you think there is any hope left for any of the people involved. I'd like to think Marie and Veronica can get past this period in their lives. I will say I didn't think Marie was as well developed as she could have been. It's not clear to me why she indulges him. Because she seems to have her act together. She owns a store. She has a car. She makes trips to London. And what exactly does she see in Alexander beyond him just being Jean-Pierre Léaud? And he has there's some boyish charm to him that he'll always have. But that's because I associate him with Antoine Donnell. She presumably would not. So...
I don't know. That's their relationship is always like the big mystery of the film. Like, I think you even said in introducing it, it's kind of unclear what the relationship is for so much of the film. I mean, I couldn't even cementally say what it is having seen the film a couple of times.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like it's one of those things where I feel like we're just supposed to accept that there are some people that we can't see necessarily what attracts people to them. And like, you meet people in real life too. There's some relationships where you're like...
yeah.
they're really bending over backwards for that person. Yeah. And I'm not really sure what they're getting out of it.
Yeah.
But there must be some history or something where they just can't let go. And I feel like it must be the same for her. Mm. And I think on the same level, she also does get some kicks out of their game. She does enjoy kind of poking and prodding him. And towards the end, especially, he starts to kind of wither under that pressure. And I think she enjoys that kind of dominion and keeping him in a certain place. In the end, she has kind of a final say over him in some regards, even if he does run free. I don't know. There's a lot of mystery to her character, and I would like to see that kind of more explored, but it's fun to kind of read in angles in there too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I want to talk about 1968, specifically May 1968, and the sort of revolutionary fervor and the potential overthrowing of Charles de Gaulle. It didn't end up happening, and how that kind of weaves its way into the film and how that becomes the backdrop for the film. Martin, do you want to take that? You want to give us a little history lesson?
I do not.
Okay. You're the European of the bunch. Come on.
Basically, it was, oh my god, like, I don't know how else, it's like the failure of liberalism in France.
Yeah.
Like, that's
yeah.
Kind of short of it.
Yeah, I think that about sums it up.
The other film that I've seen from around this time, that post 68 environment, is the Out One, which I think that takes the sort of directionlessness that was maybe in the air at the time and translates it into something differently. But I think if you watch both Out One and La Maman Le Poutin, you can kind of tell there was some sort of rut or malaise in the air.
I'm glad you brought up Out One, because I know you both did a podcast on Out One. You sat through all 12 hours.
Martin watched it twice.
Trooper. Shorter version.
Wow. Good Lord. Please tell me you prefer the shorter version.
I do not.
No,
the shorter version's, it's much harder to watch.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Good to know. Because I know eventually I will have to watch it.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this film is not, does not kind of stand alone as the definitive text of the era, of the post 68 era. But you guys can fill me in. How do they compare and contrast? Like, what, are they in a similar vein?
Yeah, I mean, I think they both have kind of an air of defeatism, and like, as much as the characters in this film kind of spend all their days talking about nothing, you also get the sense that they don't really know anything else they could be doing. I feel like today, when people in their 20s kind of waste time, we always have a sense of like, we could be doing something else. We could be volunteering more. We could be, you know, going to grad school. We could be pursuing careers. But here, I never get the sense that there's any other option that they see. There's a similar vein of that in Out One, even though some of the characters are also starting like a literary magazine out of nothing. But there's a similar air that whatever they are pursuing, be it that or the theater pursuit that occupies some other characters, there's, you know, you never get the sense that a lot of people are going to come into their show that they're putting on, or that a lot of people are going to read the magazine that they're putting out. There's kind of an air of these kind of empty pursuits, but I think that had been kind of in the air of French cinema even before 68. I think last time I saw Masculine Feminine, I'd forgotten how kind of there's like these weird bursts of violence that come out of nowhere. They're like, someone gets shot in the street for no reason. There's like this sense of anticipating an apocalypse. And then, I mean, if you trace Godard from there, you got like Weekend, which is like the apocalypse. And then you get these films, which are kind of like the aftermath. So there's a very, very much a continuum there that kind of this film is building off of. You know, Eustache kind of idolized the French New Wave, and I think in some ways regretted that he wasn't more of a part of it, especially after May 68. But I think this film operates, it's the natural kind of...
Hang on one sec.
Los Angeles' helicopters come after us. It's a natural kind of, not quite conclusion, but growth out of, I think, that movement that had been happening.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Masculine Feminine, because this movie did really remind me of that film, and Alexander definitely seems like a progression of that character, of the Leo character in Masculine and Feminine. Like,
yeah.
He's so certain of himself in Masculine and Feminine. Like, he lives to talk and doesn't really pay much regard to whether anyone else is paying attention to him talk. And it's the same way in this film, whereas, I mean, he's putting it to some use in Masculine and Feminine, like he's making a movie.
Right.
Right. But here, at this point, he's so defeated that he just talks. Like, he's dropped the pretense that he's actually contributing to society.
And there are some scenes where he's talking to Veronica where he doesn't even, like, leave the opportunity for her to, like, have a response or, like, ask her any questions.
Yep.
He's just, like, monologuing to her, basically, his tome of philosophy and loose stand-up act that he's come up with. But that's the great thing about Leod, is he kind of can't help but be himself, or that character, or whatever combination thereof resulted in that.
Although it does seem like he does a few things to play the character a little bit younger or more juvenile than some other performances, like even just Out One, like that was before this, right?
Yeah, by a couple years.
He seems younger in this film, right? Is that just me? Or
I can see what you're saying,
like,
but
the way he acts, his mannerisms, like something about him feels like a kid playing dress up a little bit. I mean, that's how he took the character in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't help that his pants are like,
right. Yeah, everything does seem quite large.
Yeah.
In Out One, though, they're always referring to him as a boy, though, that's which true. I always thought was funny because he doesn't seem like that young. But
he'll always be a child. That is his curse. I'm curious to see his new film. I'm excited. I hope it comes because he's certainly playing a grown-up.
At this stage, he can't help himself. Mm-hmm. He's 70 or whatever.
Right, exactly. And I saw an Agnes, or I'm going to start pronouncing her name correctly, Agnes Varda. But she was in the one with the Jane Birkin. I forget what it's called, but he was in it as a grown-up.
Oh, cool.
I know. It was delightful, and he really does look like a grown-up, finally, at long last. I guess he's kind of stopped working after Truffaut passed away. But I wish he'd continued. I wanted to see him grow up into a man.
He shows up from time to time in, I can't remember the filmmaker's name. Oh, Aki Kaurismäki.
Oh.
He's in, like, La Vie de Bohème for a brief second. And I think he's in La Havre, but I don't remember him in that.
Mm. I guess it's not too late. This is his great, great renaissance. Anyway, so let's talk about, or should we talk more about the philosophy of the characters? Because I'm still, like, I walked away thinking, like, these kids know nothing. I will say that the runtime became difficult just because I just didn't feel like spending that much time in their company.
Keep going back to the cafe. Yeah, keep going back to the bedroom.
Exactly. But the one scene that really kind of disturbed me was, there are a couple scenes, but basically any scene where Alexander goes and hangs out with his male friend. Who I think is nameless. He is. Good Lord. That was puzzling. Like, to me, like, I think that Alexander is, like, mostly innocuous. He's just, like, spouting off nonsense. But the friend is terrifying. Like, I don't know, stole this from some paraplegic.
Yeah.
He's got,
the New Yorker version, that's translated as some cripple, which always gets a laugh at the audience. It's, like, this very dark humor.
Yikes.
He's sort of, he almost reminded me of, like, the friend character from Kevin Smith's Clerks. Like, even the way they talk about, like, the Nazi stuff, it's almost like the way that character talked about, like, Star Wars.
It's sort of like Alexander's in kind of a transitional point in his life. He had this sort of a naive view that, like, communism could save us all, and when that fell apart in 68, here's this other point of view, and it's, here we have fascism, and, like, hey, this iconography is cool. Isn't this fascinating?
Well, I think like anytime you see somebody who feels powerless in their life or disenfranchised in some way, there's like a bit of a susceptibility to the allure of fascism. Like, it, not even like a political way, just like the way they're talking about longing for the days of when women were attracted to those uniforms. Like, you get a sense that they just want like authority. Like, I think for them, that you know, the characters, I think that's maybe what the appeal was.
Yeah, that was there was a lot of this movie that it's kind of a cautionary tale a little bit, given I know I always bring this up and then it kind of, there are some parallels to today. Kids, let's not become Alexander. Let us not do that.
Well, like, you're talking about watching this film through a post 68 lens, and like, I almost felt you didn't have to. Like, that's just what people are like now.
Yeah.
Maybe they weren't always like that. Maybe there's gaps where they're not. But, like, I definitely, you know people like that. That's
Yeah, it comes around every once in a while. I think I think there was a re-release of this in, like, 99, because Roger Ebert and Jonathan Rosenbaum both wrote about it in 99 and said that they were shocked at how much there were parallels to that time. So it makes sense that they would come back around again to now, because when they first saw it, you know, it was in the middle, when it came out in the 70s, and they were like, yes, this is very French, but we know people like this in Chicago or in New York or wherever. But by the end of the 90s, there were just many people sitting around in cafes bullshitting about nothing and kind of latching onto weird political ideologies. And so, yeah, I mean, there's another spat now of young people obsessed with fascism today. So,
yep.
And more so the aesthetics of it than like the actual implementation of it, because you get to a certain point where there's like a remove from the actual experience of fascism where you don't really have a connection either personally or familially or whatever to what it's like to live under such a system. So you're just latched on to kind of the version of it you've seen in pictures or movies, and you're like, well, I like the uniforms, or I like the speeches, or whatever, and it all seems kind of innocuous, which is sad and troubling. But I like that it's kind of kept it like a low register in this film, because it does let you kind of nags at you throughout the film and about this element of the characters without kind of it becoming overtly the point of the film.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Let's talk about Jean Eustache. And we talked about how he wasn't necessarily a part of the Nouvelle Vague. He was sort of on the periphery of it and came a little bit later. And he really only made two feature-length films. But he was no doubt influenced by their, if not their films, then their ideologies, and the sort of cahier du cinéma, like, so ideas about how what films should be. And so I thought we should maybe talk about more of his influences and see if we can determine what they are just by watching the film, or if there was anything really obvious to you, any obvious cinematic parallels. I know a lot of people talk about Cassavetes. That's in the sort of improvisational style. There's a realism. The casualness, that's not a great word, but
funny though, like, I've seen was it Pauline Gale who compared it to Cassavetes?
But yeah.
It didn't make me think that much of Cassavetes. Like, usually I think of like cameras wheeling around and people yelling, but I mean, he name drops a lot.
There was nowhere near enough. Yeah.
A low simmer. Like, I mean, it reminded me a lot of films I'd seen that had to come out since, I mean, in the film, he name drops Murnau, Nicolas Ray, Sergio Leone, Chaplin, a bunch of people, Bresson. I could see some Bresson in the film, that sort of direct people speaking kind of, I mean, it's not quite the Bressonian performance, but I don't know, maybe there's some of that in there, but.
Yeah, I don't know. He brings up Nicolas Ray, and we've had this discussion before. These guys will never learn. When you bring up Nicolas Ray, when you mention Nicolas Ray, I immediately go, why am I not watching a Nicolas Ray film right now? You shouldn't do that, right? This is, but, you know, at least he didn't say Johnny Guitar. Then we really would have been in trouble. But yeah, that's a, the, it's, do you see parallels to Nicholas Ray? I'm trying to think.
I don't really. Yeah. I don't really see that many parallels to any film. I mean, there's sort of Romero in there, but
right.
the length is much longer and is a much less disciplined film than any Romero ever was.
Yeah.
But he was definitely rolling with these crowds. I mean, I think the only reason he was able to make this film is that people kept giving him loans to kind of just sit around and write it.
Yeah.
Which, in contrast to Cassavetes, this entire film was completely written, as improvisational it may seem.
Right.
Apparently, every line of dialogue was very specifically written to the extent that they would sometimes hold up, like, cue cards on set to make sure that the actors got the wording exactly right, which is kind of a hilarious, like, dictatorial move for yeah. a first-time director making a 3.5-hour film.
Yep.
But that was France at the time.
Yeah.
You can tell it's not improvised. Like, everything's very deliberate. There's a deliberate progression of the dialogue. They usually sort of take all these weird tangents and things, but it feels very laid out. It doesn't feel that... It feels natural, but not spontaneous, maybe.
Yeah. Well, also just in the way the dialogue is delivered, it, I mean, it doesn't really sound like many other films. There's a kind of an interesting oral aesthetic to it between kind of the traffic noise and then the emptiness of the apartment where there's really no outside noise at all. But then just the way they speak the dialogue is at times like weirdly soothing and kind of amusing, and then it gets very violent. And I think there's a very measured way that the dialogue is executed that, you know, as much as it's tough to hang with the characters, I think that helps make the film a little watchable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And you never know, like, you're just like, what record are they going to put on
Yeah,
next?
Totally.
that is the one element, like, where they are as cool as they think they are. Like,
they have good taste.
They have good taste in music. I don't know. I think, like, the idea of, like, an improvisational feel is sort of, it's all a pretense, right? How do you strive for verisimilitude is, like, such a tough thing, because what does that even mean? But, and to me, like, I kept hearing that this has an improvisational feel. And I think you're right that, like, this, it all feels very, very measured. And everything comes at a very precise moment, whether it makes sense for the characters or not. And the big speech that Veronica gives at the end, like, that happens. I guess she does get drunker and drunker. And eventually, like, this sort of spills out of her mouth.
Yeah. Even though she keeps insisting she's not drunk.
Right, exactly.
We know.
Right. But yeah, everything, like, it everything feels very precise. So the idea that it could be improvisational feels silly. I also don't feel like I can measure how naturalistic the dialogue is, again, because I do not speak French. In case that wasn't perfectly obvious from my pronunciations. But I guess someone who does speak French can probably speak to that more than I can. And I think I did want to touch on, like, other films that are influenced by the Mother and the Whore. And we talked about, we've name dropped some, Tiny Furniture, Clerks, I'm trying to think of other, like, great hangout films.
I mean, like, it sort of made me think, like, not of mumblecore, but kind of the tangential, like, Alex Ross Perry, totally.
I was thinking of
Listen Up, Philip, and The Color Wheel a lot watching this. The kind of, even just the way those characters can be mean, you know, felt sort of similar. But I think you might be reminded of, like, Noah Baumbach or some of Richard Linklater's films watching this. Mm-hmm. Jim Jarmusch was apparently a fan. So was Nora Ephron. So I don't know if... I mean, you could almost...
Blowing my mind.
You know, like, some of the, like, very dialogue-driven scenes. Like, I'd be curious to kind of go back and see if I could maybe spot something in there. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it doesn't show up. Maybe it's not, like, a real influence. They just liked it. But, I mean, like, I can completely understand anyone who doesn't like this film. A lot of it feels like... Yeah, like Usash almost just transcribing the ugliest moments of his life and then putting it up on screen. Like, it almost had that quality to it. Like, I know the actress Francois Lebrun, who played Veronica, she was in a relationship with Usash, which ended before he cast her in the film. So I don't know, like, how much that plays into it, if there's, like, some element of maybe reenaction. I know that there was also... relationship he had with another woman, Catherine Garnier, who tried to kill herself and then did kill herself around the time the film was released. So, like, I know some of it feels like very, like, he's not necessarily building these dramatic scenarios out of, like, filmic references. It does feel like it's coming maybe from his own life, from maybe people around him.
From everything I've read, it's very autobiographical, which wouldn't surprise me at all because it feels very truthful and the characters don't kind of follow that prescribed way that Romero sometimes casts his characters, which they're unlikable and talkative in certain ways, but there's a very definite arc and thematic purpose. These characters like behave in weird ways that are unpredictable, but very human and very honest.
Yeah.
This is tangentially related, but I'm surprised we haven't brought up yet the element of misogyny that the film's often accused of. And I'm not just bringing this up just to be the guy to slap down accused of misogyny, because I think they're totally earned. And I think attempts by especially male critics to kind of say that the film is not misogynistic are a little dishonest, because I think like a lot of French filmmakers at the time, Godard especially, Eustache clearly has some troubles with women and is clearly using the film to work through them in some way. And I don't think the film like comes around to some perspective that's like ultimately triumphantly feminist or at all. You know, I think he's still kind of working through it. But I think the film is at least honest about how destructive misogyny can be and how lonely and isolated you can feel at the end of a particularly violent sprout of it. So in the same way, and like I said, Godard does this very well as well. So I do think the film has some misogyny within it, but I don't think that's completely invalid, I guess, because it's honest about it. I don't know. How do you guys feel about that position?
Right. I mean, I always feel a little apprehensive in bringing this up, just because then that's the lens through which I have to watch the film. And then I really have a hard time appreciating it. And given how autobiographical this film is, I get the sense that Eustache thinks of himself as being feminist, or at least some version of progressive, in that, like, he is criticizing, you know, this idea that anyone would see Veronica as a whore. Like, I think he's like, this is a version of female sexuality that he is open to and enjoys depicting, right? And I think he thinks it's a shame that society treats women like Veronica, like whores. That said, his depiction of the Marie character, I think is kind of appalling. I think it's a real weakness of the film. I think it's telling that we don't get a sense of her. She's just she comes off as kind of insane.
A little bit.
Yeah. And we don't really know why she has this attachment to Alexander. We don't. All we know is she's upset and she tries to kill herself, seemingly out of nowhere. And so the idea that, like, I think he is purposefully, he calls the film The Mother and the Whore, like this very, you know, Freudian dichotomy. And I think his purpose is to kind of transcend that dichotomy. I don't know how successful he is in doing that. And I don't know, I think he got in his own way. Like, it's, again, very, very critical of the idea that women cannot sleep around. And it shows how Veronica tortures herself over, like, how she is perceived. She's clearly very upset about how society perceives her, her sexuality.
Well, and there was this whole wave at the time of men accepting feminism if it meant more sex.
exactly.
So, like, they were, like, all for women's liberation if it meant that they were liberated to sleep with them. And you can kind of feel him being on that wave. As part of the financing, I guess Bob Raffleson contributed like $60,000 to it.
So strange.
Because he met Eustache and found him appropriately crazy.
Okay.
So if you've seen Bob Raffleson's film, you can imagine Bob Raffleson meeting somebody and feeling them appropriately crazy. You can kind of picture the kind of person that would be.
Yeah. Yep. That was my exact impression. Like, yeah, anything that leads to more sex is something that should be celebrated.
Right.
I guess it's difficult for me when we're talking about the film canon and how, like, I'm told that these are the important works. You should watch these films. And yet, in this regard especially, it feels so dated because it is attempting to kind of comment on female sexuality, which is frankly an area I suspect that these guys don't know that much about. I mean, like, or like don't actually have an act, don't really concern themselves with, you know.
But again, I don't know if it's dated because I'm pretty sure you could still find those guys.
I mean, like,
you know, without much searching.
True.
Yeah,
very,
I mean, that's kind of like the eternal trouble of the auteur theory or just the idea of authorship at all, that like it's great that we have, you know, distinct and personality-driven films, but in the end, people have their own limitations and their own short-sightedness. And so part of the reason I do think it is a great film is because of that. You know, I think that element is very woven in organically, and if you read it autobiographically, which even without knowing much about the production detail, I think you could kind of just tell just by looking at it. And you could see Alexander's same limitations transposed onto the director, and you can kind of view that film through a larger lens. So, I mean, it's all kind of tepid, and I don't expect that everyone will see it the same way, but I enjoy when films have those kind of limitations of worldviews because they feel, you know, you can really feel somebody behind it, you know, you can disagree with the film and look at it from other avenues, and the idea that, you know, every film is going to incorporate a total worldview that we can find acceptable, you know, that's always kind of a tricky situation to be in, and I, you know, I wouldn't want this to be the only type of film out there, but I do enjoy films that have short-sighted elements to them.
Fair. And I think that's a good transition point for my last question. Is The Mother and the Whore worthy of the 59th spot on the Sight and Sound International Critics Poll? Just for reference, for context, it is tied with Barry Lyndon. And I want to end Sancho Dio and Sherlock Jr.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, heavy company.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I don't think it's as good as those three.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to single out one in particular, but just thinking back on each of them, no, they're all like pretty astounding works of cinema that come as close to that kind of like total worldview as that I was saying that I don't expect every film to achieve.
Yeah.
But they come as close to it as, you know, you can reasonably expect a person to create.
Mm-hmm.
And so for this film to kind of come short, it probably isn't long in the same company. And I don't know if I would put it on my own Sight and Sound. Certainly not a top 10, but even a top 100, that'd be tough. But I don't know. Ranking things is always tough,
it's
too.
Dumb. Yeah.
So I do think it's a pretty estimable film at any rate.
Yeah, yeah. Martin?
Yeah, it's tough. I guess, like, its reputation, probably mostly in France, it must be very high, obviously, to be so high on the Sight and Sound list. You have a lot of French critics. I don't know, Sight and Sound changed the BFI changed the website, so you can't see who voted.
I know, it's so annoying.
I was like so eager to figure out who voted for this. But
me
I don't
too.
Know. I mean, I kind of want to give it the benefit.
Say their names.
I sort of feel like I should give it the benefit of the doubt, but it's hard for me to see from what I've seen on the Sight and Sound list. This feels high, but I'm also coming at it from a perspective of somebody who's not seen the film before, who's not been in the political environment that it's referencing specifically, who's not been through those emotional situations.
Like, haven't you, Martin? That's right.
No.
You're up there in Canada.
No, I could see, if you lived through an experience like this and you felt like one of these characters, like, I could see this being somebody's favorite film ever. I could also see people completely hating this film and everything associated with it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'm very wishy-washy this episode. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
It's hard to say. I guess sure.
Sure. Yeah, it is curious that it means so much to so many people, and people who are pretty young. Like, I saw a list of Mia Hansen Love's top 10 films, and she put this on there,
huh.
Which
We need a long interview with her about that.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we should have gotten her on this.
She had kind of a cool list, though, right? Like, she had like a Michael Mann film, and it was like,
yeah,
like, oh yeah.
It's one of those lists where, like, I don't even care if you like those films. It's just like, wow, that's a cool list. You know? Like,
yeah,
it was a very film Twitter list.
Yeah, yeah. It was. Yeah. Totally. Yeah. To me, this film is like, if this film were to come out 4 years from now, or 3 years from now, because 4 years from now we're all going to be celebrating in the streets. I think I would feel like it would only just kind of reinforce my sense of disappointment. Like, I don't understand why people would celebrate this. It's so sad to think of it in that context.
Well, it's showing something real, and that's kind of rare in films, you know, something that actually feels authentic and it's emotions, you know, it's not, I mean, you know, all film, whatever, like, to all extent, it's artifice, it's fake, it's phony, but, like, sure, you know, this feels, you can feel it. So, like, I think if those particular emotions mean something to you, then it's going to be a meaningful film. Who would you cast in the inevitable American remake in 3 years?
What an interesting question.
I mean, ever since Richard Brody proposed that Jason Schwartzman is like the modern day Jean-Pierre Léaud.
I was thinking of Listen Up, Philip. It's like, it would obviously be Jason Schwartzman. Either him or maybe Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah. Oh my God, he so is. Anyway. Yeah. Okay. Well, for me, 59 is way too high. Do you think that the film's reputation as kind of this French masterpiece has only grown because it is so unavailable? It is so hard to see in the US. Do you think that has contributed to its status as one of the best of all time?
I don't know. I feel so outside of its reputation because, like I said, when I first saw it, I wasn't kind of aware of it as a huge thing. And so to me, it's always been, like, at least in my memory, readily available.
Okay.
But this sort of relates to the idea of it being considered a great film at all. Just the idea of a film coming along at exactly the right time and making such a significant splash. Like, for a film that's this kind of politically and socially engaged to reflect both what's going on in France and what was going on in the US at the time, I feel like that kind of atom bomb explosion was enough to kind of carry it through being so unavailable for the memories of, you know, people who saw it at the time. And then, I don't know, I don't really get the sense from cinephiles who haven't seen it that they really, like, want it to be available in the same way that there was, like, this outcry for Out One even Brighter Summer Day. I don't know. I don't really get the sense that there's a large audience just, like, salivating for this film to be on Blu-ray.
Yeah. Well, that would kill the mystique.
Yeah, maybe.
I do feel like Out One was always this...
Out One, that had, like, a reputation, you know? Like,
yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
What's this, like, infinitely long film?
Exactly.
With this mysterious title. Yeah. And then, like, you know, wild plot. And then it lives up to it. It's...
Does it?
Oh, yeah, okay. I would say so.
Okay.
And yeah, that's true, because Mother and the Whore, as soon as you hear about it, you hear that it's a 3.5-hour film about people sitting around talking.
Yep.
So it's a much easier film to kind of crystallize than Out One was.
Yeah. Yep. I don't know. I'm sort of, as much as I am a fan of championing underseen films, I do think that this is considered one of the greatest, both because... Like, as you say, it made a huge splash at the time of its release. And also because most people cannot decide how they feel about it for themselves because they can't see it. But was there, Scott, was there anything you wanted to add?
No. Somehow I got to all my disparate thoughts.
Cool.
On the film.
Perfect.
Thank you, though.
All righty. Well, then let's move on. From one love story to another, it's time for our final notes of positivity. Martin, what's one movie, television show, book, song, article of clothing that you've been digging lately? Have any scarves you've just purchased?
My scarf collection's a little light, but I just got The Lair of the White Worm on Blu-ray. the Ken Russell adaptation of the Bram Stoker story. And that's cool in its own, but I think the real positivity is that it comes with an audio commentary by Lizzie Thurbill Russell, who we've had on the show and who's just a phenomenal storyteller. So I enjoyed listening to that, and it's worth getting, even just for the audio commentary, I think people should listen and check out the film.
Shout out to Lisi. Hey, Lisi, come back on the show. All right, Scott, how about you?
This was the part of the podcast I underprepared for.
That's okay.
I will say that the UCLA Festival of Preservation recently came to a close, It was another fantastic program. This year, they really gathered together a lot of stuff that I'd never heard of and that was virtually unseen since it had been released, which won't do our listeners a lot of good, I know. But in the specific sense, I will say that if Julian Compton's Stranded gets a proper release down the road, I would highly encourage people to check that out, as well as this pre-code comedy called Infernal Machine about like this whole plot going on a cruise ship that's also a comedy that might result in them all being blown up. But it's so weird, and the sources of comedy that they find within it are so specific and unusual, especially for the pre-code time. I think it's a very sly little film. And in the general sense, I guess I would just say my firmer idea is just to go see movies that you don't know anything about and that you can't really read up on, because you never know. It might be great.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess this will be coming out in a month. So by the time this comes out, it will have been 2 months since the UCLA festival. And speaking of, it will also come out after the Turner Classic Film Festival.
I know, it's a busy festival time.
I know. And we just had the Noir Festival.
Yes.
There's, like, you have no excuse to not be at the movies this month if you're in LA. But I also have movies to talk about. I just watched Tomorrow We Move, the 2004 Chantal Ackerman movie. And it's, again, another wacky screwball. It's like a French farce, even though she's Belgian. But the film takes place in Paris, and it's about a mother, a widowed mother who moves in with her daughter. And they kind of fall on top of each other, and there's too much furniture. and it's funny because you think of Ackerman as being very, I don't know, serious and sort of like slow. And here, I mean, I wouldn't say the film is light on its feet per se.
It's 2.5 hours long.
It's still pretty long, yeah. But I genuinely thought it was hysterical. It made me so happy to see Ackerman in this mode. And like, she's one of my favorite filmmakers, and there's still so many of her films left to watch.
I mean, talk about a director who's hard to see.
Yeah, true. But I do think that hopefully more will be coming out and more will be made available. It's great. I'm so happy that there's despite her passing a couple years ago now, there's still so much left to explore. And then the other thing is, I recently went to a screening of a restoration of Jamaica Inn, the 1939 Alfred Hitchcock film. And it was restored by the Coen Group. And I'd tried to watch this movie on YouTube because I think that was the only place I could find it. And the print was so terrible. You can barely hear anything. It was too dark. But happy to say, this new restored print looks really good, and you can hear everything.
It's
helpful, yeah. And this Jamaica Inn was the last film, I believe it was the last film Hitchcock made before working full-time in the United States. But this is the last one he made in England. And it takes place in Cornwall, and it stars Charles Laughton as this nefarious politician in Cornwall who conspires with a band of thieves to make ships wreck, and then the thieves go and plunder the bounty. And that is until Maureen O'Hara, in her first major film role, goes and saves the day. But I highly recommend that one. It's as worthy as any Hitchcock film of seeing and revisiting. So check those out. All right, you got some movies to watch. And then when you get around to that, maybe check out The Mother and the Whore. all right. And that's the way we frame it. Flicks-wise, that is. Listeners, have you seen The Mother and the Whore? Come let us know on our website, flixwise.com. Or you can like us and leave us a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. And for further lamentations on Alexander's fashion choices, you should probably follow me on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. But before you do all of that, please, please make sure to go to iTunes or Google Play or your podcatcher of choice, subscribe to our show, rate our show, and leave us a nice comment. Keep the revolutionary spirit alive. Don't let us become hapless, unemployed layabouts. Do it. All right. And speaking of Charles Laughton, on our next podcast, film historian James Naremore is returning to the show to discuss the 63rd movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. We have to do Laughton's directorial debut, Night of the Hunter. That should be fun. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, Scott, thank you so much for joining us on
the
show.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast.
Yeah, and thanks for rewatching the 3.5 hour movie. Yeah.
I mean, at this stage, I could watch it in pieces and not feel too guilty about it.
Okay, there you go. Yeah.
So.
And we'll have to find another one for you to come on.
Yeah,
that'd be great. Okay, and Martin.
Lady B.
You're going to return that wheelchair, right?
Never.
Never.